Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Talking Football. It's a podcast for lovers of the beautiful game with in-depth interviews with players, coaches, writers and a whole load more. Last week's launch pod with US-based Scottish Academy coach Ali Bain was a huge success. Thank you all for listening to it. If you haven't already done so, you can do so by visiting derekclarksport.co.uk or by visiting the Podbean site. This week's guest is a journeyman footballer turned policeman turned best-selling author, and it's packed with stories to tell. It's none other than former Scunthorpe United and Raith Rovers star Julian Brodel. It was a fascinating chat as I caught up with him at a lovely little pub just outside Sheffield, the Dog and Partridge. So sit back and enjoy this week's edition of the Talking Football Podcast. Welcome to another edition of Talking Football. I'm delighted to be joined by Scunthorpe United, Raith Rovers legend and best-selling author as well, Julian Brodel. Julian, thanks very much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I really appreciate you coming across from the other side to come over to Woodhead Pass, which obviously has been a beautiful journey for you, and you've come over to see us on this side of South Yorkshire. It's always great to talk to about the good old days.
Yeah, it certainly is, and there's lots to talk about. We'll kick off from the very beginning. You're born, is it 1964, is that right? What was it, a little village in Yorkshire near Rotherham. What was it like growing up back then?
A different world compared to these days. I got all the hand-me-downs. I had three older brothers, so I was the youngest. Lived in a little village, like I said, in South Yorkshire. Born and bred to play, either go down the pits, because that's how it was them days, and if you could get out of that, then if you could be a footballer, then that would be the thing that everybody used to dream about. And from the moment I can remember, I was kicking a ball. Like I said, got all the hand-me-downs from my brothers, so everything I was in rags, and my shoes were always having to get new shoes all the time, my mum did. And that's all I ever knew, was to try and kick a ball, and that was my dream.
So who was it that sort of noticed you had a bit of a talent about you?
Yeah, I was playing for my local team called Loughton Boys. They were quite a well-known team. We got in the Guinness Book of Records for how many goals we used to score a season, how many games we'd won. I don't know if it's still a record. So I was like a six-year-old playing with 12-year-old, so twice my age. And in those days, I was quite a decent little footballer. So it was recognised by the local managers of that team called Arthur Bowers and Alan Moon. And from that point on, there was a local scout called Eddie Edwards, who was a scout for Sheffield United. So he kept coming along, didn't realise I was a six-year-old playing with 12-year-olds. And he kept an eye on me for many years, because, of course, you couldn't sign for a team until about 11 years old, and you could become an associated schoolboy. And on my birthday, I signed for Sheffield United as an associated schoolboy, which was my team. They were my heroes.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Who was your main hero or idol growing up?
Tony Curry. Tony Curry was my hero, and probably still is, like I've said before. I see him now in my local Tesco shopping, and I'm too scared to actually go up and say, do you remember me from all those years ago when he came to see me on a television programme called Calendar? I was a talented little player at six. He'd come along as the big hero to see me, and after all these years, I've never met him, but I do see him going into my Tesco shopping, and maybe one day I'll pluck up the courage to go and, you know, just to say hello to him.
So joining your boyhood team, it must have been sort of a dream come true for you.
It was. I was at the time, I had an opportunity to go to Stoke City, which was then a First Division team, which is the Premier League now. I got that offer to go there and a couple other clubs. But there was nobody for me but Sheffield United. They were my team, they were my heroes, and they were the only team I wanted to play for.
Wait, is it a case of cleaning boots and cleaning stairwells and that when you joined them to as an apprenticeship?
Yeah, incredibly, my first manager, only for a few weeks though, was Martin Peters, the legendary who scored, obviously, for England in the World Cup final. And then he left, and Ian Porterfield come over, obviously ex-Raith Rovers, Scottish. And he came over, became the manager, leaving Rotherham United, who had just won the championship. And then as soon as I started, I left school on a Friday, started at Sheffield United on a Monday, and that's what it was. It was painting turnstiles pre-season, sweeping the stands as it was. And I had to look after Keith Edwards, very well known player for Sheffield United. In fact, he worked for Radio Sheffield on commentary for Sheffield United games, and the manager and one or two others. So I had to clean their boots and look after them, get the kits ready every morning. And I didn't mind it because that was part of the job.
Were the players sort of hard on you, or did they sort of put an arm around you when you're a youngster?
Keith Edwards didn't. Keith Edwards was one of the most prolific goal scorers of his era, and if anybody looked into Keith Edwards, he was brilliant. So he was quite a cocky young footballer, shall we say, and he would, if he could rib you, he would rib you. Now, with a name like I've got, you can imagine with Julian, he used to hammer me at times, but at the same time, he was so... He liked everything exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And I was very lucky. I was like the blue-eyed boy of Ian Porterfield at the time. And I turned pro quite quickly. I was very lucky on that sense. I don't know why, he just took a shine to me. And Keith Edwards said, "Well, what are you doing? Are you going to still keep cleaning my boots?" I'm saying, "Well, I'm a pro now, Keith." Well, I don't need to, even though I was only on a few pound a week, whatever it was. But Keith Edwards said, "I will pay you some money, extra money, as long as you keep cleaning my boots." And that was how obsessed he was. He had this thing. And in the end, obviously, I wasn't on much money, so I took it on. So even though I'd turned pro, I still carried on cleaning his football boots, and he kept on scoring. So whatever I did that, he kept paying me.
Can you remember making your debut for Sheffield United?
Yeah, again, it was a horrible winter's day. It was in those days, the football pitches, as you can imagine, were dreadful. And it was, I made my debut. I was the youngest player in 100 years history of Sheffield United to play for him. I just got to 17. I was 16 just a few days before it. So yeah, it was a big day for me, although it was only Halifax we were playing. But I was playing with people like Keith Edwards and Colin Morris and players like that. And I was probably not strong enough and confident enough to realise what I was, the situation I was in. It sort of went too fast. I had all my family there and friends all in the cop, as it was. And it was a heavy, heavy, sodden pitch. And it did take it out of me. Too fast for me. I wasn't ready for it at that point. But obviously, I'm not going to turn it down when you get the opportunity to make your debut for your home team.
Yeah. You played once, is that right, for Sheffield United? And Team 1 promotion in the year that you were there. It must have been a good vibe around the place.
It was brilliant. They won the championship. So I can say I had my little part in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was always in the squad after that. But I wasn't getting a game. And you become a little bit too cocky, and that's what I did. I came a bit arrogant. Why am I not playing? You should be playing me. But I didn't realise I was just a young kid, and he just wanted to let me have a little go, put me in the squad, get used to being with the big boys, so to speak, and I ended up leaving them. And again, who's to say what would have happened if I'd stayed? May have not had a career. I don't know. But then again, I may have played 100, 200 games for Sheffield United. You just don't know.
So you joined Scunthorpe. Was it a wrench to leave your boyhood team?
It was, because I was leaving Sheffield United with this incredible big stadium and big crowds, and I was going to Scunthorpe United at what was called the old showground, and there'd be maybe a couple of thousand people if we were lucky was there, unless, once we started. It built up as time went by, because I was playing in quite a good team. When I got to the old showground, it was a night and day compared to Sheffield United Stadium. But I had some fantastic times at that club.
And I was reading as well, you scored against Sheffield United, is that right, at Bramall Lane? Was it a case of celebrating? Did you celebrate?
It was incredible. to go back the next season, on my birthday... Under the floodlights, my first time back at Bramall Lane, playing against my ex-mates and colleagues who were there, and to score my very first league goal against Sheffield United. It's just one of those, fairy tales. But once I scored, I just didn't know what to do, because I knew all my mates would be up in the stands, and they would probably wanted to cheer for me, but at the same time, hold on, he's just scored against us, the Blades. But it was a weird sort of situation, but... It's what dreams are made of, to score against your debut goal against the team you used to play for.
You had quite a successful spell at Scunthorpe as a player. What was it that you enjoyed about playing for the Iron?
I just gained the experience, really. It was with that team, we were just a small team, so we had a small squad. You were going to play more on a regular basis, and I gained that experience and got a little bit more confidence, although that was up and down throughout my career. And then once you start scoring the odd goal, then they start to flow, and you can't, and before you know it, you know, you have those patches where you can score a lot of goals. And there was at points at Scunny where we were that close to getting promotion on a couple of occasions. But, you know, it was a fantastic time. I bought my first house in Scunthorpe, in a place called Bottisford. So all good learning experiences for a young man.
Who was the sort of big characters in that dressing room?
Scottish guy originally called Tommy Graham. Mm-hmm. The Grahams obviously played for Man United. Was it Arthur Graham? Yeah. Tommy Graham, a guy called Mickey Lester. He was an ex-Manchester City player. Quite a confident lad. We had a young lad who was below me, who was still a good friend of mine, called Dave Hill. He was a fiery redhead, played for Ipswich Town eventually. He had a lot of confidence, and he got into the team quite quickly as well. So, but mainly Mickey Lester and Tommy Graham, and there was our centre forward called Steve Kamak, mm-hmm. prolific goal scorer with Scunthorpe, probably still holds the record for scoring goals. He was a Sheffield guy as well.
So your time was 4 years there, is that right?
Just over, I'd say. And then it was incredible. The day they were digging, we had to go to get some photographs taken. Mm-hmm. Mick Buxton was the manager at that point, mm-hmm. and we didn't get on. I was sort of allegedly the best player at the club, mm-hmm. but he didn't think so. So when we went to get photographs taken for the new stadium that they were going to build, we had the photographs done, the usual ones with a spade into the ground and a digger at side of us. And then I drove over to Barnsley and signed for Alan Clark again, because Alan Clark was my manager for a while at Scunny. And then I went over to sign for Barnsley that same day. I joined Barnsley, who were then in the second division. So it was a no-brainer. I was going up a couple of divisions, and I'd be playing in the second division, or the Championship, as it's called these days.
And with no, obviously Barnsley will be a sort of rival to Sheffield United. Did you think about that, no, at the time?
I didn't, because at the time, Sheffield United had long gone, been many years since that had happened. I'd gained a lot of experience in scoring a few goals, and I was super fast in those days. Hard to believe when you see me now. But then I was a really super fast player. But when I got to Barnsley, obviously at that level, it was so fast, and the way Barnsley played at the time, the football was brilliant. It was just, you know, one touch, two touch football. Mm-hmm. We had some great players there, and I thought, ooh, am I good enough for this level? But like everything, you get used to it, you settle down, you get in, and then before you know it, you're playing on a regular basis and you get used to it.
Yeah. You mentioned there Alan Clark, of course, he wrote the foreword to your book as well. What was he like to play under?
He was an unusual character as a manager. He'd taken everything from the famous Don Revy. Don Revy was Alan Clark's hero as a manager. So everything what Don Revy did, Alan Clark did. So, it's out there already. We play bingo on the coach. You know, we'd be going to play, I don't know, big clubs in London or something, going to stay in posh hotels in London, and yet we'd be playing bingo on the coach. We'd stay at some posh hotels in London, and we'd be playing bingo in the hallway in these red tracksuits, and people think, this is crazy. And he used to do a lot of stuff like that. We'd come in for training, we'd train for 10 minutes, and then that's it. That's all you need. But you know, it was unusual. But obviously, he's become one of my heroes over the years, because he's always he's helped me two or three times. Mm-hmm. He's written the foreword in my book, and he's always been there for any advice. So I can't knock him. I think he's been brilliant, and you can't imagine, as a footballer these days, he'd be probably worth 80, 90 mm-hmm. million, because he was a brilliant striker for England and Leeds United.
Yeah, certainly. You climbed up two divisions, as you mentioned there. Did you notice a jump in the standard and the quality that you were facing?
Yeah, it was a better quality, and in that particular league at the time, because I played for him for 3 years, there was, and I can't say which particular season, but there was like Newcastle United playing down there. There was Leeds United, of course. I think there could have been Tottenham. There was a lot of Manchester City. There was lots of big clubs that, playing in that division, so it would have been difficult to get out of. And again, one particular season, I think we missed on the playoffs by a point. Brilliant team, learnt a lot, and again, unfortunately, when Alan Clark left, somebody else took over called Mel Machin. Face didn't fit, so it was moving on again.
And you moved quite a fair distance as well. Plymouth, how did that all come about?
It was just... I was just brought into his office, and I've put it in my book, this. Mel Machin had just signed a two-year contract, because, again, I was one of the best players at Barnsley at that particular point. I was playing regular, you know, everybody's supporters were behind me. Alan Clark left, Mel Machin come along, my face didn't fit, and he sold me without telling me. So he brought me into his office and said, "I've sold you to Plymouth." I thought, sorry. I says, "I'm going nowhere." He says, "I've sold you. I've spent the money already on somebody else." And I says, "Well, I'm not going." So they brought secretary in, and they offered me a few quid. So I thought, well, if I'm not wanted, I'm not going to get a game. I might as well go down to Plymouth. And Plymouth was beautiful. What a place to live for a short time. Plus, my firstborn child was born down there.
Yeah, I've done a game down there. It's a fair distance, but it's a beautiful sort of place. Who was down there? What sort of players did you play with down there?
There won't be well-known players fielded. Ken Brown was the manager, and he was amazing. Again, that only lasted for about 3 or 4 weeks before he left. And Kenny Brown Jr. was there. Tommy Tynan, of course, was the striker, who's like a hero, was a legend down there, who did play for Sheffield Wednesday at some point. So, the main ones was like, who else was there? He used to play for Man City. He's just knocked out Kilmarnock, his manager.
Oh, yeah.
The
boy.
Welsh team. Jock Morrison?
Andy Morrison.
We call him Jock Morrison. Yeah, Jock Morrison. He's got Scottish heritage. So, yeah, Jock Morrison. God, I did well to remember that. There's people like him who was just quite new at that point. Yeah. Mark Edworthy. He was a young lad, and he did brilliant over the years for different clubs in London. So there's a lot of potential at Plymouth. Again, it was in the Championship as we know it, and they held their own while I was there. But again, my manager who signed me left. A guy called Kemp came in, who's been assistant manager for quite a while with him, who was manager at West Brom for years. He'd just been sacked at Middlesbrough.
Pulis?
Yes, Tony Pulis. Yeah. David Kemp, I think, is his assistant manager.
Yeah.
So David Kemp come along, and again, face didn't fit. So on you go. So I ended up going from there right up to Scotland.
Yeah, it's quite... So what made you go to Scotland? Was it somewhere that you fancied, or did it was just one of those moves out of the blue?
It was just one of those moves out of the blue. Somebody knew somebody.
Yeah.
And so I went up there, and... when I got there, it was crazy. I was asking for a town called St Mirren. I had no idea. It was obviously in Paisley.
Yeah.
But then
you wouldn't know.
I didn't have a clue, and that was embarrassing. And when I got into the taxi, St Mirren had just played Rangers, and I said, "Could you take me to the St Mirren?" And he's saying, "Don't you talk to me about them, so and so." He was quite, and that's the first time where religion came into football. Mm. And obviously I spent many years up in Scotland, and they worship football in Scotland. Mm-hmm. But you're right, Celtic or Rangers, a lot of them in Scotland, and St Mirren had just played Rangers and had done them over, I believe, so he wasn't a very happy person, because he thought St Mirren was a Catholic sort of team, which it didn't really come into it at St Mirren.
Yeah.
It was Rangers and Celtics, it wasn't, as you know, being a Scotsman.
Yeah. Your manager then, was it Tony Fitzpatrick at the time? Was he in charge then at the time?
Yeah, Tony Fitzpatrick. Again, it's one of my regrets. I never really played well for Tony, and yet he backed me all the way. He was a lovely guy, worshipped at St Mirren. They absolutely love the guy, and he still works for them. And I just regret I wasn't... That's the problem with me. I always had to settle in at a club. It used to take me a few months to get the feel of it, to get the banter with the players and all that sort of thing. But by the time I started producing, he'd left, and Davey A took over.
Yeah.
And Davey A, originally, now this is the unusual way for me, he didn't want me straight away, but on one occasion we were playing Dunfermline away, and he had to play me because he was bringing a lot of his ex-Celtic players in, Davey Elliott and one or two others, Chick Charlie, and one or two others. And he had to play me because of injuries, and we played Dunfermline away, and we ripped them apart. I scored, I had a cracking game, and I could hear him saying to the press, "This guy, I've got him wrong, and I'm going to give him a chance." And I thought, "What?" And he apologised to me in front of all the players that Monday, how he didn't realise, you know, he should have given me a chance. And I played him week in, week out with Davy A, and I couldn't stop playing well, and there was a lot of big clubs looking at me. And then he left. Jimmy Bone came along, and the same story. I had to move on because we didn't get on.
You mentioned some of the players there. There was quite some talent there at St Mirren at the time. I mean, they had a young Paul Lambert there, of course. What was he like? Did you notice at that time that he would go on and achieve, or win the Champions League and play well for Celtic?
He did really well, didn't he? And he's still obviously in the game. No, he was the blue-eyed boy at St Mirren, but he was struggling with his confidence. But you could see he had all the ability. But we were playing as individuals. You know, we had Steve Archibald playing for us, Thomas Stickroff, you know, as German, Gunny Toffers, an Icelandic international, Victor Munoz, Spanish captain, and all those games he played for Barcelona and Espanyol and everything. So we had all these players, plus Paul Lambert and many others, but we were playing as individuals, not as a team. We had some outstanding players, but with Paul, he was struggling with his confidence, but you knew the ability was there, the touch was fantastic, he just needed that confidence. And he needed to move away, which he did, and as we know, he had a fantastic career.
Yeah. Chick Charnley's some character. Was he sort of life and soul of the dressing room, I'd imagine?
He was a bit of a character, and if anybody in Scotland will know Chick Charnley is, he's legendary at Partick Thistle, and because they love him at Partick Thistle. St Mirren, a cracking player, like I said, just at the wrong time. But he was one of two things what happened over the times I was there, but I can't really say it on radio.
In terms of, I mean, of course St Mirren have moved stadium now, but what was it like playing at the old Love Street?
I loved it. Once I got my confidence, I was playing well. It was a cracking ground. It was a big ground, quite open. Although I didn't like running around the track on a Monday or Tuesdays, you know, during the daytime when we were doing our training. It was a horrendous big track. But to play there, fantastic stadium, great history. And the new stadium's amazing. It's not the same as it never will be, but the stadium now they've got is fantastic as well.
Yeah, the short spell back at Scunthorpe on loan, then you short spell at Partick Thistle as well. How did that all come about?
John Lambie, again, he's one of these unusual characters, God bless him. He took me on, and I can remember the first programme he wrote in it, and says to the Partick Thistle fans, "Wait until you see this guy's left foot. It's the sweetest left foot in the league." And I thought that was amazing to put that. But again, my confidence was shot. I couldn't hit the barn door. You know, I was poor at Partick Thistle. And it was one of those where, you know, they probably wanted me away and I needed to get away. But it was so bad, John Lambie sent me to a psychiatrist. Honestly, he put me with a psychiatrist to try and get me to sleep and make me come back as a world beater and stuff. But it didn't work. But fair play to him. But he was such an unusual character. I've written in my book down the line about him. And he'd keep the ball off us. We wouldn't have a ball for 4 or 5 days. And then you'd ask him, so one of the lads asked him, "Why are you not letting us have a ball, Gaffer? We need to practice training different." He said, but then when it comes to Saturday, you'll all want the ball. You'll want to grab it and get hold of it. So that was his thought process. So we did that quite often. So we wouldn't touch a ball for 4 or 5 days.
The Raith Rovers move, how did that happen?
Again, Martin Harvey was an assistant manager at Plymouth Argyle when I was at Plymouth. He was now assistant manager with Jimmy Nicol up at Raith Rovers. And they thought maybe I could give them some experience because they'd just gone up Raith. It didn't really work out that well because we went down, but they were a brilliant footballing team. Great potential players. But most of the players at Raith were either players coming to the end of the career, or there were young lads just starting in the career, free transfers, that sort of thing. There was no big time Charlies, obviously, bar Gordon Dale. He was a bit of a, as you know, Dazza, he'll never change Dazza. Yeah. Dazza is what he is, he's brilliant. But everybody was just mates, and we just got on so well. So again, took me a few months to settle in, but once I settled in, the experience we had then was second to none, of course. It's probably the biggest part of Raith Rovers' history, and I was part of it, and I'm so grateful for that.
Yeah, we'll talk about the League Cup in a minute. Jimmy Nicol, though, as a manager, what was he like to play under?
Fantastic. All he wanted to do was, he's like, you had your running sessions, but most of the time it was to play football, practice football, but a lot of banter, a lot of fun, a lot of taking the Michael out of each other. But that built up the camaraderie amongst the lads. So there was, we did a lot of playing golf. We'd go to Ireland golfing because, you know, a lot of the lads like to play golf. He was from Ireland, so we had a lot of experiences in Ireland. And nights out, having quite a few drinks. It was just to bond us together. But the team I went to, they were a fantastic team, and he had brought it all together. He'd seen, obviously, talent there with the young lads, like Mickey Cameron, Stevie Crawford and players like that. And then he had Craig Brewster and Heatherstone, Peter Heatherstone. And they put all these players together with Gordon Dalziel, and he just scored for fun. As everybody knows in Scotland, he was a prolific goal scorer. So joining this team, it was difficult at first to get into it because they were so close. But once they let you in, it was a fantastic, probably the best time of my life.
Yeah, the 94-95 season's of course legendary with Raith Rovers. The League Cup final, I think it stands out. Can you remember much about that game against Celtic?
I can remember the party afterwards. it's been documented in my book. I was scared of losing my place. And in most of the games that I played in, you know, the quarterfinals, semi-finals, I was struggling with injury. But I thought if I told them I was injured, I'd be dropped because we had Jason Rowbottom, and he was a brilliant player. He could play anywhere. And I thought, there's no way. And Audi didn't see I was limping up. Probably it's just the way I run, maybe. I always look like I'm injured. But once you told us the team, I thought, great, this is my chance to play in a cup final. And what an incredible time. I thought we matched them all the time. You know, it was one of those. It was a classic game. I'd love anybody, if they can, get the chance to see it. Brilliant game. And obviously it went down to penalties in the end, and I had no doubts that our lads would score the penalties because they were confident of doing it.
Yeah, I was going to say, leading up to the game, you must have had the belief that you could beat them because you go in as massive underdogs in a game like that.
Yeah, we had nothing to lose, and Celtic hadn't won anything for quite a while, and they're a massive club, and I don't think a lot of people in England realise how big Celtic and Rangers are. They're incredible support. And like I said, on that particular day, that final was actually played at Ibrox, of all places, and they had three stands, you know, and we had just one part of the stadium. It was totally full of Raith Rovers fans, and you knew you had nothing to lose, but you wanted to win. And with Jimmy Nicol behind you, and we had a speech. We stayed in a hotel at Erskine. I was telling you before, I used to live in Erskine for a while. And he gave this incredible speech, and you thought, you just didn't want to let him down. But he probably thought, you know, you never know. We've got our young lads. They weren't scared of anything. You know, Colin Cameron, and like I said, Stevie Crawford and people like that, Jason Dare. They just had the belief, and they were outstanding on the day. And it was probably those guys plus Gordon Dalziel, dare I say it, pulled us through.
And it's probably one of the most successful days in the Raith Rovers history. Did you realise when you won the cup how important, how momentous the day is?
It was, you don't realise until afterwards, and every so often it'll come up on YouTube or someone will invite us up to Kirkcaldy to something at Raith Rovers. So when you go up there, you still appreciate how much the supporters remember it and how much they still love you, even though I wish I could put a shirt on now, but one wouldn't fit, of course, now. But I wish I could turn back the clock and enjoy the moment. But it just happened so quick. But I know we did did a training session after we'd won, and the TV cameras came along to watch us training, and we had to pretend it was before the game. So we'd already won it, and it was the weirdest thing. Like the TV, we're doing it for some documentary or something maybe. So we had to pretend it was the build up to the game, and yet we'd already won. But you could see everybody's heads were absolutely smashed because Jimmy Nicol, after we'd had a big do at a hotel in Kirkcaldy that Sunday, that evening, and he says, "Look, guys, we've got a game next week, you need to make sure you get back by Wednesday. And because he knew wherever we went in Kirkcaldy, we would have been invited into every pub, even into people's houses. You know, you can have a drink with us, please. And that's how it was. It was amazing.
Yeah, that season was such a successful season, getting promoted by a point as well over rivals Dunfermline. So it was, I mean, like you say, one of the best seasons of your career, would you say?
It was, probably the best. But obviously the following season we played in Europe as well. But yeah, because we were doing well in the league cup, you know, the Coca-Cola Cup. But we couldn't do anything during the league, in the league games. But then as soon as we won the cup, bang. But I don't think we lost a game. And if we did, it was perhaps one. But we just kicked on from there, and we just timed it perfectly to play, funny enough, at Partick Thistle's ground. That was the last game. Davy Neary, that was his last professional game as well. He was playing for us. And we had to get a draw. We got a draw, and we won by one point. It's incredible.
You mentioned there Davy Neary. How was it like to play alongside him? Because he's, of course, a world-renowned figure in Scotland.
Yeah, he's a character. If you're old enough, you'd know he doesn't do interviews. He doesn't talk to people. He gets changed after a game. He's gone. And he was like that at Wraith. But training sessions every day, me, him and Scott Thompson, the keeper, we shared a car to go to the training ground. It was a few miles away to go training. So I got to know him. And off the pitch, people think of him of a certain character, but you couldn't be further from the truth. He's a funny guy, brilliant laugh, great experience, of course, as a footballer. And he would never come forward with, like, look at me, how much I've won with Scotland and how well I've done as an international, how well I did with Dundee United. So never mentioned it once. He was just one of the lads, a cracking guy, and I still keep in touch with his family now.
The following season, of course, the highlight must be playing Bayern Munich. What was that like?
Yeah, amazing. Like I said, we Jimmy Nicol wanted, and Raith Rovers wanted, somebody big to play against. And in the beginning, we played, I'm not even going to try and pronounce it. It was in the Faroe Islands, so we beat them home and away, fantastic. I got man of the match, by the way, for the very first European game, incredibly. And then we played the Cranes in Iceland, home and away. They were a good team, but we got through there. And then we ended up getting the big team who we wanted, who went on and won it, of course, was Bayern Munich. And like Papin and Lothar Matthäus and Klinsmann and all these sort of players. It's incredible to think that our little team was going to be playing this mighty club, who are still one of the biggest and best clubs in the world now.
I mean, you're playing there at the, obviously, Olympic Stadium. That you're looking around at these players thinking, this is unreal.
Yeah, we did go to train on it the night before, and we got there, and all the lads and all the staff have got the video cameras out and things like that, because it was just so overwhelming to think this stadium, the history of that stadium. I even see it today. I'll put YouTube on, and Guns N' Roses, they played there, and I think, God, it's packed. I've played there. And I don't know that Guns N' Roses is a band. It seems strange I'd pick that, but it comes on a lot on my YouTube. I think, God, I played there. It's amazing. But yeah, it was my birthday that day as well. But one of the funniest things was, and it's well documented with this one, is we were beating them at half time. And you think, these are superstars, and it's just little old Raith Rovers, free transfers, like I said, and young kids and guys, end of their careers. And you could hear him, the managers having a right go of him. We were just listening to the wall, because there were huge changing rooms, these. And Jimmy Nicol just started laughing. And then next thing you know, we all start laughing. And it was just one of the incredible moments in your career when you're thinking, here's Raith Rovers playing Bayern Munich, who are superstars, at the Olympic Stadium. We're beating them 1-0, and we're laughing and think, this is crazy. And we had chances to score again. You never know. But what a brilliant experience. One of the funniest things also is this is the difference between Raith Rovers and Bayern Munich. Bayern Munich, after the game, they're doing all the interviews with the German TV crews and radios, and they're all big, tall Germans, you know, very slim and sleek and stuff, doing the interviews. Then they were going off to a training camp to prepare for their next game in the Bundesliga. we all came out of the changing room. There was about six or seven of us holding crates of beer in a long line. And they didn't touch the drink, but we were going with all these crates of beer, which Bayern Munich had clearly given us, because they must have known what we were like in Scotland, in Britain. And that's it. And I thought, this is the difference. But it was a fantastic night that night in Munich. It was brilliant afterwards as well.
Did you get any players shot after it?
I did, and he was called Zickler. I said, I had to play against him. He was this super slim, tall, blonde-haired lad. Yeah. And I had to mark him at home and away. And we just swapped shirts. He's probably my shirt. He's probably washed his car with mine or something. But mine, I've still got it, believe it or not. And it's great. Every so often it falls out the wardrobe. And, oh, yeah, I can remember that time. I just wish I could have fitted in it even in those days.
When you left Raith Rovers, were you sad to leave the club?
I was devastated. They ripped up the team because Jimmy Nicol left to go to Millwall. And he took one or two of the better players, the young players, who had all the potential and went on to do well, of course. And so they ripped it up, and they should never have done it. They should have kept the core of the team, and plus the fact people like myself was experienced players. But they didn't. They wanted to change it. They clearly got a few quid out of Europe and stuff, and they spent it on a lot of players. And I left, and I was devastated to leave. I wanted to stay, but clearly I wasn't wanted by the management at that point.
Yeah, and your time in the game was coming to end. Did you feel that in your sort of legs? Some players know that the time's up, but did you sort of feel that the time was night hang up the boots?
Yeah, I'd got an offer from East Fife, which was just down the road. Steve Archibald, obviously, I played with him at St Mirren. He was the manager, and they were going for promotion. And he says, well, can you come along and with your experience and stuff, you'd be able to help us just get it across the line. So I thought, well, that's fantastic if he believes in me. So I went to East Fife, but I was training on my own because it was a part-time club. And I was going there in the evenings or during the daytime, and I thought, well, what do I do? And you lose your fitness straight away as soon as you stop training on a regular basis. But we never lost a game, and we got promotion, so that's something. Every game I played in, although I didn't play that well, we got promotion. Yeah. But then that summer, I wasn't offered a contract with East Fife until the very last minute they offered one, because Ross County had stepped in, and that's the reason I went to Ross County, because East Fife left it too late.
I mean, Ross County, so the back and beyond, it's really, really, really north. So, I mean, is that something you had to think about, or did you enjoy your brief time up there?
The lads were brilliant. It's a different world up there. They certainly can hold a home when it comes to drinking whiskey and things like that, the beer. Cracking little club, lovely chairman at the time, really built for, you know, getting up the league. Like I said, they had a few quid to pump into the club, but it didn't work out in the end. But unbeknown to me, that would be my last club. And I think I've said, I played against Caledonia Thistle, their rivals, at their ground. I didn't know that was going to be my very last game, but it was when I drove away. I didn't know that at the time, it's very sad the way it ended. I wish I'd just had another season with somebody, but it didn't happen.
So When you hang up the boots, then do you have any idea what you're going to do after life as a footballer?
The problem was, again, if it was now, you'd want to stay in the game because the money is just ridiculous now. Even probably as a scout or something, I don't know, or some perhaps on the staff in some way as a coach with the kids, I don't know. But I had been playing football for 17 years from the moment I left school. And I thought, I need to get out of this and do something different. I want to see a different world because I've been looked after for 17 years as a footballer. So I thought, let's get out of this. And incredibly, I joined the police. My dad was a cop when we, as a young man, and I thought, yeah, let's do it. So I ended up joining the Greater Manchester Police.
And your time there, I mean, you've got a couple of commendation awards and that sort of thing as well, so you certainly took to it.
Yeah, I fell over one or two things. One where someone in the middle of the night attacked my police car and they were armed robbers. That's with a shotgun to my head. They smashed the car. It was a sledgehammer through the windscreen. Wow. It was a scary thing when they're saying, you know, give me your keys, I'm going to blow your head off. And the other one, of course, I stumbled across a young girl who was unconscious underwater, and fortunately we got her back back to life. And yeah, it's incredible, these little stories, and it all helped with my book, of course.
Yeah, certainly.
As well,
it's a massive sort of switch. Was it difficult to begin with, joining the police from life as a footballer?
Yeah, like I said, as soon as you stop playing, your fitness goes bang. And every time you try and kick a ball, you're like an old man, like I am now, you know. And it was just so weird. I tried to play for Greater Manchester Police, your local divisional team. Mine was Stockport at the time.
Yeah.
That's who I played for. And I thought, you know, what am I doing? They were probably looking at me thinking, well, he was a footballer for 17 years. He's hopeless, you know. But you just lose your fitness, you lose everything, and you're not playing with players at that standard I was used to, if you understand. So I gave up altogether and just concentrated on trying to be a good police officer.
Yeah.
You've been involved in some situations as well, reading the Dale Cregan thing as well. That must have been a bit traumatic as well for you.
Yeah, Dale Cregan, horrendous, because of course what happened to two of my colleagues, two female officers, it's horrendous what happened, and I was the only person allowed to stay on the scene. Everybody else from that division, it was Tameside Division, that particular one, I've moved to there. They were all taken away from the scene, but incredibly, I was allowed to stay and take reports, knock on people's doors, what they saw. But it was a horrendous, horrendous time, and it took Greater Manchester Police a long time to recover from that.
Yeah, it's a different world, I guess, from the world of football, where you're sort of insulated, I guess, and now you're sort of real life. This is people are dying in front of you.
It's hard to imagine, but with, you know, the things I've seen in my life, like I said, I've been in cocooned and looked after by football for 17 years, then suddenly you're seeing horrendous situations, bodies, car accidents, murders, and of course someone trying to attack me and things like that. And it just makes you wonder how you can get through it. But most of the police, they have to, because without them, where would we be without the police? A lot of people hate the police, but when you're running one way, they're running towards the danger to try and look after us. So, incredible people.
We'll just touch on it briefly. 2016 was a traumatic year for you.
It was, yeah. Some people might say, did it happen so you could finish your book off? I don't know. No, horrendous. Jane, my partner, thinks how I stood up to what happened to me. She says she would have just buried her head and never come out, you know, at the house. But it was a horrendous incident what happened to me. It's still ongoing. There's still an investigation about it ongoing. But I gave my account of what I thought had happened. And in the end, I was dismissed. And so you can imagine, the worst thing what happened to me is they told me no one would find out about it if you go quietly. And it was everywhere, TV, press. And it's nothing worse, because you've got to inform your family. And the fact is, then I had to leave in December 2016. And then where do you go from there? Because when you start looking for a job, everybody knows, or they'll Google you, because you have to say, oh, I was a footballer for 17 years. Oh, I was a police. Why did you leave the police? Nobody will touch you. So it was horrendous. And I just grabbed hold of any job I could get hold of. Just to pay the bills.
Yeah, it must have been tough, and it led you on to, of course, writing your book. What sort of gave you the inspiration to pick the pen up?
I'd been writing a lot for years about myself. I thought one day, because I split up with my children's wife, their mum, of course, I thought, well, they don't know anything really about me. They were still quite young when we had the glory years at Wraith and what have you. So I thought, I'll start writing bits and just put it on jots of paper and just put it into a corner in the house. And eventually, I got quite a lot of this paperwork. So a good friend of mine called Stephen Lawther, who also wrote his own book about Wraith Rovers called Unthinkable, he asked me to write. He did a chapter of me about that particular time. And I asked him, I says, well, I've put a lot of this work together, you know, some paper. He says, can I see it? I says, yeah, of course you can. So I sent quite a bit via email. He says, this is really good, Julie. And he said, you've got more? I says, yeah, I've got pages and pages. He says, send it all to me. And he had got a publisher, a real well-known publisher, who does a lot of sports people autobiographies. And they wanted to take it on. He says, can we have you? Sign up for us. I thought, what? You want a book about me? He says, yeah, well, You're a journeyman footballer of 17 years. You was a cop of 16 years. You know, there's a lot of stories in there. What's happened to you? So I was going to sign up to him, but then they said it's going to take at least another year before I can publish it. I just lost my job with the police, and I thought, do you know what? I can do this myself. So I did it all myself. We got it published. I got advice from a part-time publisher, Baby Step Publishing, who helped me and advised me. But then we published it via Amazon, and it went number one in the world. It was incredible. In September 2017.
And you can't possibly imagine that the success of that when you obviously got them published. Could you do so well?
No, I was hoping, you know, some people would read it, sports people, yeah. You know, maybe going on holiday and think, well, he looks all right on front of the book. He's an ex-footballer. Maybe I'll take it with me. If I'm bored, I'll read his book. But it's suddenly at number one, and it knocked off Sir Alex Ferguson off number one. Difference is, though, I wrote my book. He doesn't have to, but that's fair enough. And it knocked Stevie Gerrard down to number four, I think, as well. So it was brilliant for a couple of weeks. It was number one. And I can always say across the world it was number one. And the thing is, it just doesn't go in, as we call it, football. In America, it goes with all their American football superstars as well. So it goes into that category with the big American footballers, not just soccer, as they call it. And it went to number one. It's amazing. And it's helped me to go around a lot of my old football clubs and talk. I got on the microphone, or I did. And I will talk to people about it. I've been on radio talking about it in newspapers. And it helped me through a very tough time. Instead of, like I said, hiding, I says, no, I'm going to go out there and represent my book, represent me. I'm a decent lad. I've had a good life. I want to put my story out there.
Yeah, certainly. Is there plans for any more writing in the future?
I've got a book in mind. I've written 30 children's books, but I don't push them. I don't publicise them. My intentions, God willing, I'm seriously thinking of moving to Spain, depending on Brexit, of course. I want to get the sun on my back now. I'm getting to a certain age. I'm thinking of moving to Spain. Now, if I do that, then I'll concentrate in publishing all these 30 children's books I've already written. They're done. They're out. You know, they're ready. I'll probably write another book about something I've got in mind. But, we'll just have to see. But like I said, hopefully, if this goes out there, if there's anybody out there who wants me to scout or get me back in the game in a little bit, because I'd love to do that as well. I'd maybe consider using my experience to just check, you know, see kids on a Sunday morning or go to football matches and do reports. That'd be interesting, but no one's ever offered me. I've kept in touch with one or two people, like Derek Adams, who's just left Brother Dargyle.
Yep.
I keep in touch with him on social media and one or two other managers or coaches, but I've never pushed, give me a job. So to speak, I'm not that sort of person. I'm too proud. But if anything comes up, I'd really appreciate it. Of any, perhaps on your part, more my writing and stuff. Yeah. You never know.
I'll have you think about it. If people want to maybe get a copy of it down the line or get in touch with yourself, Julian, how do they go about doing so?
The incredible thing about Amazon is I don't have 1,000 books in my garage which I can't sell. Yeah. The great thing about Amazon is if you want a book, one book, they publish one book and it'll go to Holland, Germany, across the world. If you want 100 books, they print 100 books. So I only have 2 books at home and they're the proof ones, they're the actual originals. So you just go on down the line, go on to Amazon, put down the line in and my name, Julian Broddle, it'll come up. And I still get people, you know, messaging me and say, what a great read it is. I'll just give you one story. I've said this when I used to go around promoting it. There's a guy who got in touch with me on social media. I was gone for a walk, and I could see him talking to other people saying, I'm not sure which book to take with me on my holidays. And there's other people replying to him, obviously mates of his. And he's saying, well, what is it? He says, well, down the line, the Julian Broddle story, or Johan Cruyff, you know, one of the biggest legends in the world, played manager Barcelona, played for Barcelona, Holland, and he couldn't make his mind up. And it came back as, well, this is interesting. So eventually I thought, oh, look, see what they've said, these guys. And this one guy said, take both of them, because you'll not put Julian's book down. You'll have read it within 2 or 3 days because you'll not put it down. So take the Cruyff as well. You'll need that for the rest of the week. And I thought that was brilliant. So hopefully it's I've had some incredible reviews on Amazon. No negatives. And it's been fantastic for me.
Excellent. Julian Broddle, it's been a pleasure speaking to you.
been a pleasure, and thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, that was episode 2 of the Talking Football podcast with Julian Brodel. I hope you enjoyed it. Feel free to leave a comment in the comment section if you did. And of course, if you didn't, the podcast is available to listen across a whole range of platforms. But if you want to keep up to date with the latest goings on, you can reach us at derekclarksport.co.uk via Twitter at @talking_football. And we also have a Facebook page as well. I'll be back next week with another belter of an interview. But for now, thanks for listening to the Talking Football podcast.